Chris Hedges. Quite simply, he is one of our nation's most remarkable and insightful and cultural critics and authors. For over 20 years, he was a foreign correspondent in Central America, in the Middle East, in Africa, and the Balkans for such news media as the New York Times for 15 of those years, the Christian Science Monitor, and National Public Radio. While at the Times, Chris and his team received the Pulitzer Prize for the reportage on global terrorism. The same year, he received Amnesty International's Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. Chris writes a weekly column for the award-winning political blog TruthDig.com and has authored six major books, his most recent, The Death of the Liberal Class, from Nation Books. And he is on the Nation in its special area of being a scholar. Nice to have you with us today, Chris.
Thanks, Gary.
Chris, I wanted to take the opportunity to share with this audience how you articulate a problem. And if you would, please bear with me till I read your article. Are you up for that?
Sure.
Okay. Chris is a part of our conversation with Remarkable Minds. Now, just before I went on the air today, just after I got off 6 hours of KPFK, our sister station, I was told by Richard Gale that Op-Ed News would no longer be allowing any articles or reportage on anything that was not pro-vaccine. That's odd, because there's an enormous amount of scientific evidence and articles showing that vaccines should be held to a higher standard of accountability because they're mandatory. It's not as if you have a choice if you're a child or a baby or going into the service or working in a hospital. You have to have them, and the public's convinced they're safe and effective. Well, we led the way last year. Richard Gale, myself, of researching and publishing 12 articles, all that were fully scientifically referenced, to challenge the notion that the swine flu vaccine was the answer to a pandemic. A, we proved there was no pandemic, and B, that the swine flu was not even effective or the flu vaccine for this. And that was not refuted. Now, why in the world would Op-Ed, which was one of the progressive blogs, and I commend them for that, suddenly exclude everyone who had a progressive idea? And we are investigating the money trail today and their new sponsorship on that. And we've written them a critical letter stating that if that's their position, we can no longer support that and will no longer post on them. That doesn't mean anything to them, but to the millions of people who care about independent reporting that goes against the grain, it does. I was also told by my brother this morning, Stephen Knoll, who's a major activist. He got all the lead out of the cars in India. No one else had done that before. He got the lead out of the cars in the Dominican Republic. He's off the Dominican Republic this morning. He got the children in the Dominican Republic and India to get free chelation therapy by the local doctors to get the lead out of their system. He sees that every single pregnant woman in the Dominican Republic has free vitamins, prenatal vitamins, that can help prevent eclampsia and miscarriages. He does this. He is one of the most unsung, in my opinion, my brother, human rights and activist environmentalists in the country. And he's very shy and he's very self-effacing. He doesn't like media and won't even come on this show. But he said, Gary, you're aware that, you know, in your documentary of vaccination and autism made in the USA, you made it, you know, now this famous pediatrician, the most famous up Columbia, saying, gee whiz, you know, you should not have defended Andrew Wakefield and you should not have done all this reporting showing any affiliation about anything wrong with vaccines. As why is that, Steve? Everything I report on, I can prove. So let me get this right, Steve. You're saying that if a pediatrician says that there cannot be any association between a vaccine and any injury in a child, I should accept that and not do my research. I should just accept that that's true. Then would I go to any general practitioner who's giving a woman synthetic hormone replacement therapy and say that I should not question synthetic hormone replacement therapy like Premarin? And say that the breast cancer, ovarian cancer, colorectal cancer, heart attack, stroke, and dementia has nothing to do with that when the scientific literature overwhelmingly proves that 13% of all 10 million American women, that's 1.3 million American women, are being sacrificed on the altar of medical ignorance and hubris to make a profit for the vaccine makers because nobody wants to be bothered at looking for the truth? Sorry, Steve, can't do that. And I won't do that. What we said in the film and what I did on the air is show that vaccines have not been proven safe or effective for a given person. The scientific evidence is overwhelmingly supportive of that, including the Cochrane group out of Italy, which is the most independent group of scientists in the world evaluating research. And the head of that group, Dr. Jefferson, so stated. He was my source. Now, if the local pediatrician wants to do his homework and get off his dead ass and actually show that how he's been inoculating children without having the knowledge, and he is sacrificing those children to autism and mitochondrial dysfunction and the capability of having problems, then that's his responsibility. But he should not turn to a journalist like myself and say, don't do your work because it might end up giving us information that embarrasses us. Well, that's what independent journalists do. They go after the story that everyone else has already closed the store on, as we just did with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who is being pummeled in the world media, called a fraud and a charlatan, lost his medical license, and all 12 doctors along with him were discredited for experimenting on children and claiming they had diseases due to the MMR vaccine when they experimented illegally and unethically. And therefore, that was the charges brought against them, and that was the evidence, and they lost their license, and now they're being pummeled again. Just when Paul Offit's book on pro-vaccine comes out, one little problem, no American journalist, not one American journalist, not one person from ABC, the New York Times, CNN, actually looked at the evidence. When we did, we found, gee whiz, there are 10 letters that we have, all signed by the ethics panel of the Royal Free Hospital, giving permission to these 12 board-certified pediatricians to do biopsies and to do examination of these children's gut. Therefore, they were innocent. It was a fraud job. And the man who caused all this, affiliated with a pharmaceutical company, including, guess what, the maker of the MMR vaccine. How did they miss this story? So a kangaroo court took away licenses. And did they interview the parents? No, we did. Did the parents say their children were abused? To the contrary. You heard them on a 5-hour special on this program. They were innocent. And now we're asking for a full investigation. Who did I have on the program? Mr. Clifford. Who is he? A chief barrister before the Supreme Court of England in all civil litigation. What was his findings? That I had the only copy of all the letters showing that these men got full permission, they did no experimentation, and what they found was a rare and unique and original inflammatory condition in the bowels of these children, all of whom received the MMR vaccine, and that was the association. It was not the autism, it was that. They were accurate. The article published in the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, was correct. Therefore, this is the vaccine industry saying, how dare you challenge our vaccines? Why? Because if it's shown that the MMR vaccine causes the conditions that these doctors are suggesting, then the British government would be responsible for probably between $500 billion to $1 trillion in damages, the government itself. So it was a wide effort to cover this up and hurt the doctors. Well, we have the evidence. We presented the evidence. Mr. Clissard now has the evidence, and that evidence was not presented at trial. The accuser had the evidence and withheld it. I ask a simple question. Is that, in the United States, that would be called obstruction of justice? He said it is true also in the European, in the United Kingdom. So now, when that story was closed, the story was over, you couldn't possibly think that there was anything wrong with the MMR vaccine. The Lancet had withdrawn the article. They had repudiated all this. Now they were shown to have been wrong. Our program was the one that put it up there. But now Op-Ed wouldn't cover that. Who's going to cover it? Who's going to cover the truth? How about no one in the mainstream media? So the Internet is our source. And so the truth will get out. Now to Chris Hedges' article. Why do I say all this? Because many of you have used the Huffington Post as your primary source or one of your major sources for getting progressive information from progressive authors. My problem, I've never considered Arianna Huffington a progressive. I've considered her a very rigid ideologue, first on the right, then on the left. I have not considered most of the articles in there to have been cutting edge or challenging or really in-depth reporting. So, little surprise when it was sold. What's now going to happen? Well, what's going to happen, I believe, is you're not going to see those critical articles that could have been at home as a forum. Here's what Chris Hedges has to say. I'm quoting now from TruthDig.com, Huffington Plunders. Quote, I was in New York City on Thursday night at the Breck Forum to discuss with the photographer Eugene Richards his powerful new book, War is Personal. When I was approached by an interview by a blogger from the Huffington Post. I just finished speaking with another blogger who had recently graduated from the University of California, Berkeley. These encounters, which are frequent at public events, break my heart. I see myself in the older bloggers, many of whom worked for newspapers until they took buyouts or were laid off, as well as in the aspiring reporters. These men and women love the trade. They want to make a difference. They have the integrity not to sell themselves to public relations firms or corporate-funded propaganda outlets, and they keep at it the way true artists, musicians, and actors do, although there are dimmer and dimmer hopes of compensation. They are victims of a dying culture, one that no longer values the talents that would keep it healthy and humane. The corporate state remunerates corporate management and public relations. It lavishes money on the celebrities who provide the fodder for our national mini-dramas. But those who deal with the bedrock virtues of truth and justice and beauty, who seek not to entertain but to transform, are discarded. They must struggle on their own. To sell the Huffington Post to AOL for $315 million and the tidy profit of reportedly at least several million dollars made by principal owner and founder Arianna Huffington, who was already rich, is emblematic of this new paradigm of American journalism. The Huffington Post, as Stephen Colbert pointed out when he stole the entire content of the Huffington Post and rechristened it the Colbuffington Repost, produces itself. The highly successful site, like most internet sites, is largely pirated from other sources, especially traditional news organizations, or is the product of unpaid writers who are rechristened citizen journalists. It is driven by the celebrity gossip that dominates cheap tabloids, with one or two stories that come from the New York Times or one of the wire services to give it a veneer of journalistic integrity. Hollywood celebrities, or at least their publicists, write windy and vapid commentaries. And this, I fear, is what news is going to look like in the future. The daily reporting and monitoring of city halls and courts and neighborhoods and government, along with investigations into corporate fraud and abuse, will be replaced by sensational garbage. And the web packages that and makes it look like news but contains little real news. The terminal decline of newspapers has destroyed thousands of jobs that once were dedicated to reporting and verifying fact and giving a voice to those without these new news organizations. Newspapers, although they were too embedded among the power elite and blunted their effectiveness in the name of faux objectivity, at least stopped things from getting worse. This last and imperfect bulwark has been removed. It has been replaced by internet creations that mimic journalism. Good reporters, like good copy editors or good photographers, who must be paid and trained for years while they learn their trade, are becoming as rare as blacksmiths. Stories on popular sites are judged not by the traditional standards of journalism, but by how many hits they receive, how much internet traffic they generate, how much advertising they can attract. News is irrelevant. Facts means little. Reporting is largely non-existent. No one seems to have heard of the common good. Our television screens are filled with these new chattering celebrity journalists. They pop up one day as government spokespersons and appear the next as hosts on morning news shows. They deal the currency of emotion, not truth. They speak in empty cliches, not ideas. They hyperventilate with a spin from the left to the right over every bit of gossip, and their corporate sponsors make these court jesters millionaires. We are entertained by these clowns as corporate predators ruthlessly strip us of our capacity to sustain a living, kill our ecosystem because of greed, gut civil liberties and turn us into serfs. Any business owner who uses largely unpaid labor with a handful of underpaid non-union employees to build a company that is sold for a few hundred million dollars, no matter how he or she is introduced to you on the television screen, is not a liberal, it is not a progressive. Those who take advantage of workers, whatever their outward ideological veneer, to make profits of that magnitude are charter members of the exploitive class. Dust off your Karl Marx. They are the enemies of working men and women, and they are also, in this case, sucking the lifeblood out of a trade I care deeply about. It was bad enough that Huffington used her site for flagrant self-promotion, although the cult of the self has reached such dizzying proportions in American society that such behavior is almost expected. But there's an even sadder irony that this was carried out in the name of journalism. This latest form of liberal exploitation exposes yet another, again, in the liberal class for who they really are. Opportunists whose operating methods are as callous as those employed in the textile mills in southern China. Is it any wonder that working men and women who have been abandoned and betrayed by these self-identified liberals hate the liberal class and its transparent hypocrisy? Is it any wonder that some 40 million Americans who live in poverty are invisible to the wider culture? Is it any wonder that the Tea Party and all the lunatics on the fringe of our political spectrum put their crosshairs on the liberal class and its purported values? Let us not forget the title of Huffington's latest book, The Third World America: How Our Politicians Are Abandoning the Middle Class and Betraying the American Dream. Liberals like those deserve the rage they engender. The argument made to defend this exploitation is that the writers had a choice. It is an argument I also heard made by the managers of sweatshops in the Dominican Republic and Mexico, the coal companies in West Virginia or Kentucky, the huge poultry farms in Maine. It is the argument made by the comfortable, by those who do not know what it is to be hard up, desperate, or driven by a passion to express oneself in the world through journalism or art. It is the argument the wealthy elite, who have cemented in place an oligarchical system under which there are no real choices, use to justify their oppression. In conclusion, who would not want to be able to carry out his or her trade and make enough to pay the bills? What worker would decide that they should decline the possibility of job protection, health care, and pension? Why do these people think tens of millions of Americans endure substandard unemployment? If Huffington has a conscience, she will sit down when AOL delivers the check and make sure every cent of it is paid out to those who work free or at minimal wages for her over the last 6 years, starting with Mayhill Fowler, the blogger who broke the clinging to guns and religion story about Barack Obama during the 2008 presidential campaign and spent 2 years writing and reporting without salary. Quote, she strung me along for 2 years while I repeatedly asked for funding for the three projects, and then I quit, unquote. Fowler told me from Oakland, California, as I spoke with her by phone. When Fowler, whom the site nominated twice for a Pulitzer Prize, finally resigned last year in disgust, Mario Ruse, the spokesperson for the Huffington Post, acidly told Yahoo, quote, Mayhill Fowler says that she is resigning from the Huffington Post. How do you resign from a job you never had? Unquote. That comment says it all. It exposes the callousness of our oligarchical class and their belief that they have a right to use anyone who can contribute to the moments they spend their lives erecting to themselves. End quote. Chris Hedges. Chris, first of all, thank you for writing that. For a lot of us, it put in perspective what a lot of these sites mean and what has happened to a once-honored profession, and how few real investigative journalists we have alive today. Please take us on your journey to explain your concern about what you see happening today on the blogs, in the mainstream media, the ideological rigidity of the left and the right, and how few real stories that impact real people's lives are ever dealt with. The forum is yours.
Well, I spend a lot of time talking about the press in this new book, Death of the Liberal Class. And what's happened, in essence, is that the newspapers have lost their monopoly that they once had, connecting sellers with buyers. This created the possibility for thousands of American journalists to earn middle-class salaries. And I'm not blind to the complicity that the commercial press has with corporations and the power elite. Indeed, I'm quite critical of that relationship in the book. And yet, it did create the possibility whereby institutions such as courts, police, city government, city hall, all of these things could be monitored, however imperfectly. Now that monopoly has been broken, now that sellers no longer need newsprint to collect with buyers, we are watching the major metropolitan dailies in this country die. Many of them are in bankruptcy. And if you go to cities like Chicago or Philadelphia, the city's newspaper is anemic, reduced to a few pages, especially if you remember 10, 20 years ago when these Sunday papers could weigh up to 5 pounds. And it's not being replaced on the Internet. Because journalism, like art, like music, is not being compensated on the Internet. And as you mentioned in the article I wrote, the only thing that the corporate state compensates is public relations or corporate management or celebrity culture, which functions as a kind of diversion as the predatory forces of the corporate state hollow the country out from the inside. And the Huffington Post, for me, is sort of emblematic of what people are going to, or what's going to be presented to people as news. And of course, most of it's stolen. The term is aggregated. But even more importantly, it's celebrity garbage. It's trivia. It's gossip. There's very, very little real news. And I think that that's extremely dangerous as these lights go out. I mean, good journalism shines a light on those areas that the power elite seeks to remain from public view, seeks to hide within the darkness. And I think as that those search engines disappear, and the people who have the kind of drive to do that can no longer find compensation for their work. We are entering a period, a very frightening period, where the culture becomes even more disconnected from reality. Before you read my article, I mean, some of the issues you touched upon, especially in terms of the environmental crisis, are extremely serious. We don't have much time left. And yet, we are busying ourselves and investing our emotional energy in spectacle, and in these mini dramas that celebrities create for us, a kind of ongoing soap opera of one or another. So I think in the end, my attack on the Huffington Post is that they are, while of course she presents herself as a liberal, they, in the same way that I suppose many of these talk show hosts on MSNBC present themselves as liberals, they speak to the same narrative. They're all court gossips. They're courtiers. They may give it a different spin, but they still are talking about the same Sarah Palin quote. They're still talking about the same issue, albeit from a different slant. But in essence, they're not talking about what's real, and that is the rapid reconfiguration of American society into a very frightening form of neo-feudalism and an assault on our ecosystem that, if left unchecked, and there is nothing to see that it is being checked, we've shredded Kyoto, will make existence for on the planet, for certainly the human species, extremely difficult. I mean, that's really the seriousness of the issue we face. And I think that you know, however you paint yourself when you play this game, as Huffington did, you empower the very corporate forces that are have unleashed this destruction.
I appreciate that insight, Chris. I have just two more questions for you. One with just a little preamble. I just returned from a 33-day road trip. I was on the road by myself in a car with my camera, and I drove through, you know, I filmed in Mississippi and Louisiana and then Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans, Texas, all around, and I wanted to film the stories of the average American, the average working-class American, who is now suffering some severe privations, frequently working. At one time, they had living wages. Now they have service industry wages. One guy said he went from $80,000 a year working as an engineer to now he stacks boxes in a Walmart for $8 an hour, and he has to do it. A woman who is not, she's only 60, so she's not getting Social Security and won't for another 6 years, and she's not getting Medicare, and she's sick, and she lost her job, and she can't compete with the younger people because she had seniority. So she's lost her home. And I'm talking with all these people, and they're asking basic questions. For example, in the Ninth Ward, there's one block that has been improved, nicely so, with solar panels on the roofs, and Habitat for Humanity and Brad Pitt's organization did these about 7 homes. But then I went to hundreds, even thousands of homes that are just completely devastated and destroyed. You only have a few homes that have been repaired. Major potholes, cars upside down, trees split, everything. It looks like the day after Katrina. And indeed it is. It's just many days after because nothing's changed. In the middle of all this, I was told to go to the bus. Well, there's a bus in front of this one house. I finally found it. It didn't have an address. And in the backyard, I see things growing. Just a regular backyard. And so I looked around, and I finally found some young fella. And I said, "What's going on here?" And he said, "Well, this is a garden." And then he put the word out, and like 16 people showed up, all teenagers. And evidently one guy from Oregon, from Brooklyn to Oregon, Oregon to there, in a bus, showed up and took over one of these old buildings and bought this little lot, and he rehabilitated. Now they got 9 greenhouses, and it was 38 degrees. This is just 2 weeks ago, Saturday I was there. It was 38 degrees outside, but 80 degrees in these little made greenhouses, and they had sprouts growing. And the bottom of it is they were supplying 22 restaurants in the French Quarter and the Flower District. They were earning an income. They rehabilitated. They took all these restaurants' foods and were composting, making organic fertilizer. And so I went up on the buildings, and all of which were broken, abandoned, and I filmed that it would just remind you something out of World War I, trench warfare, and in the middle of a trench there's like a garden. That's what it looked like. But I said, here's hope. Here are people who are teenagers are working. The guy's teaching classes every day for free. They're learning agriculture, hydroponics, sprouting. They're making an income. Everybody was happy, and now they're spreading this on other blocks throughout the Lower Ninth Ward. And I said, wow, this is a story of hope and recovery. They did this without any state or federal or local assistance, no charity assistance, and yet the media will go to that one single strip of houses on one single block where Brad Pitt and show all that good, 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 and they refuse to turn around and show all the bad. And here people, instead of being angry at a society that has forgotten them, are recovering. And then I met all the homeless vets, and I found over, are you ready for this? 16,000 vets who are homeless, living in pup tents, and many of them have illnesses. There's no running water, electricity, and yet they're surviving. They're working together. I saw the people taking cans of food out. I found one guy. He hadn't been out of his pup tent in 4 days. He was dying. He had infections from tubes coming out, and I got him in. We got him his medicine. He didn't have money for medicine. Do you know that he had a ticket? on his way back from trying to find work, and he had to walk 4 miles to work, and he had two stents in his chest 2 weeks before. He sat on a public bench to recover his breath, and a policeman came over and gave him a ticket for loitering. And it's not against the law if you or I sit on that bench, but if you're an unemployed vet, it's against the law in Florida. And if he doesn't pay the ticket will double in cost. And then if he doesn't, the sheriff will come out and arrest him and put him in prison. Do you know that we have all these prisons in America filled with homeless vets who did nothing more than ask for a dollar or sat on a bench? It was insane. Who knew this? Well, I helped him, I paid his tickets, got him, and I just said, this is pissing me off. I filmed all this. I did a whole film on this. I put it up on the web. It went viral. I started organizing. And lo and behold, the public began to become aware of it. But what really bothered me, Chris, is the newspapers locally hadn't handled it. No journalists had handled it. No public agency, state agency, civil agency, or federal agency, the VA, hadn't handled it. The Veterans Administration hadn't handled it. The Pentagon hadn't handled it. The White House hadn't handled it. You've got 980,000 homeless vets in America. Sorry, Sean Hannity. And I ask one of these vets, a former major, a woman who lost her home, has been living on the street. And I filmed her. Her name is Red. You watch that. You go up on Gary Noll and you watch that homeless vet segment. It's called U.S. Government to Our Vets Drop Dead. That's how I labeled it. And you see their real story. And I said, you hear Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity and Geraldo saying, you know, honor our brave soldiers. Have they been here to honor you? No. So they get you to go to war, but when you're exposed to depleted uranium and anthrax vaccines and botulism vaccines and post-traumatic stress disorder, and you come back and you've lost your home, your family, and you're out on the street, they're not there for you then, are they? No. Well, what hypocrisy then? So I got them to tell their story, and I asked all the neighbors. I went door to door and knocked on. You'll see it in the film. I said, sir, you're aware that behind you in this little patch of woods, you've got hundreds of vets who are homeless. Yeah. Have you gone out there to ask them, can you help them, bring them some food? No. Why not? Well, you know, they're homeless, you know, alcoholics and drug addicts. I just interviewed a bunch who are neither homeless or alcoholics. They're just poor. They served you and our country. Shouldn't we just as human beings help them? It's not my problem. Government will do it. Boom. Those are the stories I came back with. I came back with stories about obesity and diabetes in children that is not being addressed. So then I look at Rachel and I look at all these other shows and I say, where on the left are we covering these important stories that make a difference? I don't see them being covered. Where on the right? I don't see them being covered. And I'm concerned that we're not covering the important stories. We're more interested in Sarah Palin's, you know, latest gaffe and or Michelle Bachmann than we are in addressing real and pressing and important issues. 240 million Americans are hungry and poor and desperate, and there's no advocates or voices for them. We can demonstrate in Wisconsin. Good. I support that. Why aren't those same people demonstrating against those who are poor, homeless, obese, sick, without help? Your thoughts, Chris?
Well, because the corporate state has quite effectively rendered all of these people invisible. And every time people see flashing glimpses of them, as they did after the devastation in Katrina, they're sort of shocked that Americans are living like that. But as you know, and I just came back from southern West Virginia where I'm working on a new book, there are gigantic pockets of the United States where living conditions resemble those of the developing world. The more we retreat into this celebrity culture, which Huffington embraced wholeheartedly, the less these people's voices are heard, with devastating effects, because I think one of the things that has angered me on figures like Clinton and Obama and others, and including Arianna Huffington, is that they continue to speak in the traditional language of liberalism and yet have abandoned core liberal values. Clinton and Obama are probably the poster children for this, so that you, when you have liberal institutions that no longer function, that no longer act as that kind of safety valve that makes incremental or piecemeal reform possible, then you see leaping up around the fringes of society these very frightening proto-fascist movements. And I think the rage that is expressed by these movements like the Tea Party is a legitimate rage. Not only towards the betrayal that they have undergone, but also against a liberal class, the hypocrisy of the liberal class. The danger is that of course they make war on the values that these so-called liberals purportedly defend. Of course, they don't defend them, and that just accelerates the assault against civil society. So I'm as concerned as you are that there are at this point tens of millions of people in this country who are suffering severe deprivation. And our response, as we see, I live in New Jersey, in the state of New Jersey or Wisconsin, or certainly at the federal level, is essentially to cut the programs that provide them any kind of basic support and make their situation even more precarious. And eventually there will be a backlash. But my concern is that because the liberal establishment has been bought out and sold out, that backlash will be a very virulent and frightening right-wing backlash.
Okay, I appreciate those insights. My final thought on this is that I believe that if we're going to talk about liberal values, we should manifest them. If we're supposed to vote people into office to get us out of these wars, then hold these people that we put into office accountable for funding the wars instead of getting us out, for funding the bailouts of banks and the gangsters on Wall Street instead of funding social programs that would help us, instead of funding a single health care program that would ensure that everyone was covered, instead giving the money to the insurance companies. Everything that you could possibly do in the opposite of what they promised they have done, and it's time that we look for the truth. Otherwise, then we're continuing to support systems that ideologically are supposed to be right, but in practicality are not. And I just came from the front lines of American life, and everywhere I went, I saw people who do not have advocates, who do not have demonstrations, do not have marches. People are not demonstrating to put a moratorium on home foreclosures, to stop repossessions. You see what we could do. We have $13 trillion the Federal Reserve has given to major banks and hedge funds and equity partnerships at zero interest, and took toxic debts off their bank's balance sheets to make them clean, and they won't give a nickel to help the average person or stop the home foreclosure. Something's terribly wrong with that scenario. And I want to thank you, Chris Hedges, for going down to West Virginia, my home state, and challenging Barack Obama's notion of clean coal and mountaintop removal with as if that's a clean energy. It is not. Gas is not a clean energy. Nuclear is not a clean energy. These are devastating energies. But what could make us clean? Solar, wind, geothermal, and energy from waves in the ocean that we know we could use and could become totally off the grid. We are not, because of the special interests, both the Democrats and Republicans. So keep up your good work. You always have a forum, always have a home on the Progressive Radio Network with all the others, Danny Schechter and Helen Collicott, Michio Kaku and Jim Hightower, and the people who speak truth to power.
Thanks, Gary.
Chris Hedges, my guest, and he is not only a remarkable mind, he is, in my opinion, one of the most articulate spokespersons for a humanistic, spiritual, independent, and progressive way of solving our problems.